Welcome to the Daily Canon Podcast. Here to talk all things Arsenal is your host, Matthew Wade.
Hello again, listeners. Welcome to another Daily Canon Weekly Podcast. A slightly less enthusiastic intro this week for a slightly less enthusing week to talk about. But joining me to try and make sense of it all and work out how we can move forward at this difficult time is Anita Sambol, all the way from Croatia. How are you, Anita?
Wow, that's a good intro, yeah. I was so excited about the football coming back, the project restart, as they call it, and then Arsenal happened.
yeah. Well, and not just Arsenal, as we'll get on to. But yeah, I suppose, given this is an Arsenal podcast and two games happen, we have to talk about them a bit. what did you make of the defeat at Man City? As you may have noticed, both Paul and I predicted a defeat. I predicted a narrow one, which was Paul was perhaps slightly closer to the mark with his prediction.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if anyone expected a win at City. I think it was like last six or so matches they scored three goals against us, so it was, you know, in perfect circumstances it would be tough to win there. But now, after the restart and the long break and all the fitness issues and everything, yeah, it was hard to expect a win there. A narrow defeat, yeah, that was more realistic. I would go with that prediction as well, but yeah, it obviously didn't happen
thanks to a few things, because obviously, I mean, football's back, the Arsenal injury curse is back with a vengeance. It's the voodoo built into the Emirates Stadium seems to still be working fine. Obviously in that game we had Granit Xhaka turning his ankle in, what, the second minute? Or was it the first minute? I can't remember.
I think he had one touch before that, yeah. I said a lot of times over here on this podcast that I really like Grant, and I think that he's definitely one of the key players in this team, which was again seen mostly noticeable when he's not playing rather than when he is playing. And I think that it was very noticeable in the City match and in the Brighton one as well.
Yeah, it's one of those difficult things, because obviously those of us with dreams of all-conquering glory that our memories give us, recognise that Granit Xhaka is not necessarily a player at the standard to take us to those heights, but we're a long way off those heights, as we'll get on to, and Granit Xhaka remains flawed, but are still one of our most reliable in terms of what he can bring to the team, midfielders, and certainly, I mean, we've seen it there a lot of times this season that when there's no Xhaka, our midfield has no structure. He's got his issues, but he's the closest thing we have to to control in the centre of the park. So that obviously hurt us. And then Pablo Mari's Achilles went on 23
after
minutes.
A really okay start by him. Yeah, it was really good to finally see him play.
Yeah, and you could see that his left-footed distribution would give us options in the future. I mean, unfortunately, yeah, his Achilles went trying to keep up with Raheem Sterling, which is always a bit of a vain effort given how much slower Pablo Mari is and always will be than Raheem Sterling. What did you make of the performance up to that point in time?
Well, I mean, it was as expected. City had the initiative. I think it was the free kick that De Bruyne had that almost went in as well. Bernd Leno was again so important and had some really good saves. Mm. And going up front, it was just like that whole match felt like our midfield was just, oh, let's get over with it and end this match and move on to the next one. It didn't seem like they had a clear idea what to do up front, and Aubameyang was there, left completely alone without any help at all.
I mean, I thought in the first 15-20 minutes, I thought, you know, it was obvious that we were slightly conceding initiative, but I did think up to that point in time, we, you know, perhaps there was the equaliser of lack of fitness and lack of rhythm, but I thought that we were looking dangerous every time we counter-attacked, and we were having little spells of possession and ball transition in that early part of the game, and Eddie Nketiah was causing them problems just with his pace and his work rate.
Yeah, I think he was actually the best player going up front for us in that match.
Yeah, in terms of the front three, I completely agree. And possibly
you could see that there was some kind of plan going forward that Arteta had in his mind, and then with Xhaka going off and Mari afterwards, it just fell apart.
Yeah, and obviously City was starting to get a bit of modicum of control just before Mari went off, and in the following 20 minutes Bernd Leno was kept busy, but I suppose we have to talk about it. Cometh the hour. I mean, we don't need to really analyse the mistakes. They're mistakes. I've got a little bit of sympathy for Louise on the first one, because the ball skipped up more than I would have anticipated. It seemed to take a slightly funny bounce, although Louise's body position was questionable, shall we say.
Such an experienced defender.
I mean, obviously the second goal and the penalty, the sending off, the whole kit and caboodle basically ended the game and completely buggered Arsenal's preparation for Brighton in a lot of ways, because it's obviously incredibly sapping playing against one of the best ball retention teams in the world with only 10 men.
Yeah, it's just like everything went wrong with that. I mean, it's a cliche to say that, you know, we couldn't anticipate that and it just happened. It's like with Arsenal when it just doesn't, one thing doesn't go wrong, it's like 5-6 things goes wrong at the same time. I mean, David Luiz wasn't even supposed to be playing at all, and then he came on and ruined the whole match. It's just, it happens. I mean, I'm really, that match, I did agree with what Arteta said afterward the match, that he wishes he could lead that one from the hard drive, because it's tough to, you know, learn from that, except perhaps, you know, to instruct our midfield players to be a bit more confident going forward, because there was those few videos going around how Aubameyang was running up front and no one was passing the ball to him, rather than passing sideways on him or even backwards, which was just odd thing to do. But other than that, I think it was just one, it looked like one off match, you know, when a lot of things went wrong and a lot of individual mistakes happened at once. And lastly, but not least important, we played against a really good team that has been playing together for so long, and they had all the players fit. So.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that was very much overlooked, isn't it? It because of the influx of money and because of, you know, the Sky Sports Premier League, marketing brainwashing, you know, people seem to think that this Man City team and the way it's constructed is normal. And the fact is Man City's bench costs more than the entire Arsenal squad.
Yeah.
Their first team costs like 3 or 4 times the amount of the team that the Arsenal could put out. Yes, that's partly because we had a number of young players, which is also part of the issue. I mean, ultimately, we saw a few occasions where players like Nketiah and Willock and even Saka had promising moments, but didn't make the right decision at the right moment, or didn't execute when they did make the right decision at the vital moment. And that's always the thing. It's, you know, there's that's the difference between those players that really make it at the top level and those that might not, is that somewhere around this age they start to develop the decision making capabilities to be decisive as opposed to just promising. You know, we all saw with, say, someone like Fabregas, how even as an incredibly composed and talented 16-year-old, there was a point when he was sort of 20, 21, where it suddenly went up a notch. You know, he already had that vision and decision-making to the most part, but then his decision-making became more assertive and more
with more conviction behind it, and suddenly he was a massive goal threat and leading the team and basically being the man. Now, none of the players we've got coming through are at an equivalent level at the same age. But
yeah, it's a bit odd, I'd say, because as mentioned, that video of Aubameyang being a bit angry that the balls didn't get to him. But there was another video from the training just a few days before where you could see that Arteta, what was his plan, what he was preparing the players to do. And they did pass the ball to Aubameyang, and he did get a chance and scored. I mean, yes, it is a training, but they were prepared, thought to do that exactly in the match as well, but they just didn't repeat it. Is that the confidence issue?
Well, I mean, you're very right to raise that, because you know, so much of what dictates a player's ability to succeed at the highest level is mentality or mental strength or coping with pressure. And of course, you know, when you're the underdog, there is a huge mental aspect to playing, particularly if you're playing a stylistically similar game, to playing against a team that you know is better than you, and after a point in the game of starting to get into the ascendancy, you know, it's hard to maintain that same kind of mindset that makes you always look for that pass when you've spent 10 minutes doing shuttle runs to try and stop the opposition getting that pass. I mean, you know, it wasn't a great game and neither team was at full throttle, but it was a game that really illustrated the incredible difference in strength in midfield areas.
Yeah.
I mean, De Bruyne was just, you know, I've found myself sort of saying, despite David Luiz's interventions, and more on those in due course, if De Bruyne had been in an Arsenal shirt, we might not have lost that game. His ability to dictate play in the central midfield, to accelerate the play, to play passes which either dissect defences or turn defences on their heels from seemingly improbable positions, is an extraordinary high level. I mean, he is one of the top five players in his position in the world, without any shadow of a doubt. And we don't have anyone in midfield who has that playmaking ability. And I'm even including peak Ozil in this. Ozil has very different great abilities, but you know, De Bruyne's capacity for playing, stretching through balls, is better than anyone that we've had at Arsenal since Fabregas, and certainly since Cazorla. I think that was a massive deciding factor in the game. Not to mention the fact that, of course, on top of that great vision and control, De Bruyne is quite an impressive physical specimen as well. So he's able, you know, he's strong and quick as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he's I'd say exception to what a midfielder is like. I mean, he's just one time in the generation. It's hard to expect that we would have someone like that, and like two or three other teams would have someone like that. So it's a bit, yeah, odd. I mean, he's once in I already said it.
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we definitely don't have a player like that. Dani Ceballos looked like he might be the solution to our midfield problems, but it seems like that one
once upon a time in a season far, far away.
But then we still caught ourselves thinking, okay, maybe we could go with a much worse option. Maybe that's the best that is available right now, because he knows the team, he knows the manager, etc., etc. And then it's just like, you know, settling again.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it's hard to really disagree with Arteta's assertion that one should just sort of write off the Man City game. I mean, hey, losing two of your starting 11 in 20 minutes away from home against one of the best teams in the world, and then having someone come on, give away two goals and get themselves sent off. I mean, short.
You can't plan for that. There is no plan B for that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing you can cope with if you're like a a league championship level team, as you know, as Arsenal have shown us in the past. But even that's extremely challenging. But when you're a team that is struggling for identity, when you've got a starting 11 which is half of them are kids or people who are still not fully fit after lengthy injuries or both, and then it's disrupted like that, and then you get a player sent off, and again, you know, there's a limited point in getting into detailed analysis, and I'm sure that some of the things we might draw out of the City game are much more pertinent in the Brighton game. But the only other thing I really wanted to ask about the City match is, obviously, it does bring up the David Luiz situation, and you know, we can't ignore his pronouncements afterwards. I mean, what,
he fast to step up and give interviews.
Yeah, but obviously there was something else in that as well. I mean, what did you make of it?
Well, his comments about the contract. And
Yeah.
It felt like that was all that was on his mind, perhaps even during the match and the preparation and everything, thinking what will happen next, will he stay here, how his paycheck will be and everything like that. Like, it kind of, you know, explains the decision-making in the match. Maybe his head was elsewhere, and that's definitely not something we need on the pitch at the moment.
Well, certainly, I mean, the very nature of his interview made it very clear how much that was a preoccupation. And, you know, on a human level, one can be sympathetic, because despite the fact there may be power plays going on, and we can talk until the end of time, until about Kurir Jerebshin and Rouse, and yeah, his contacts-led approach and where the dangers of that lie, and obviously how the agent is being a massive fucker for trying to get a 2-year contract on a 1-year extension, otherwise he'll leave in a fortnight, you know, trying to massively exploit the situation, even though it's the global situation, which is the only reason there's any uncertainty in the first place. I don't know how much we can attribute it to just to that as well, because, you know, David Luiz has had some really good performances this season, but none of them have been in big away games, or away games against big teams. We saw the same penalty tricks against both Liverpool and Chelsea, got himself sent off against Chelsea, where very clearly from the get-go in that game, obviously there's a personal reasons for that as well because of his relationship with Chelsea, but his head wasn't in the right place there either. And of course, this is something we've seen over David Luiz's career, is that in big games it goes one way or the other. We've seen him perform, you know, for Chelsea in the Champions League final, he was absolutely brilliant. But we've also seen him have one of the worst individual defensive performances in living memory in the World Cup semi-final for Brazil at home. And he's, because of his emotional nature, I think, and the way that he always tries to intervene and almost tries to take too much responsibility, he's a sort of player that in a high emotion pressure situation, he really, really benefits more than most from having structure around him. And then that allows him to concentrate more on what he does well, which is the distribution and defending his penalty area without feeling like he needs to step out and take control, which tends to be when things go wrong. And I think he's one of those players that would have been very badly affected by the absence of Granit Xhaka, actually.
That's a good assessment.
Well, there we go. Well, we'll see if anyone listening agrees with me. But, you know, if you do, that's a nice start. So we lost at Man City. Everything went wrong, and we were probably going to lose anyway. So, obviously, we then got the news that Pablo Marie's injury was worse than feared, and he might be out for the rest of the season. Great.
When we are trying to evaluate if he's worth keeping after the loan.
Exactly. Although all the noises that we've heard since seem to suggest that the club have concluded that he is. But I suppose having already paid half of his fee in a loan fee and potentially having 1, 2, or 3 centre-halves who have 12 months or less left on their contracts, I suppose it's get the warm body in while you can. But obviously we've seen that Granit Xhaka is also going to miss a lot of what's left of the games as well with his injury, which is probably the bigger issue.
And then we found ourselves in double quick time back at another away game at Brighton. I mean, this was obviously a really strange game because I don't think anyone watching it, you know, who wasn't some biased commentary wanker, could say that Arsenal didn't do enough to win the game.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. And I mean, Arteta said that after the match, and it is really true because we definitely looked much better, especially in the first half, which was Saka who hit the crossbar and Lacazette header, and Aubameyang looked really lively as well. So again, the cliche, unlucky not to go in.
Yeah. And of course, ultimately, we didn't really, I mean, it was sickening, but we didn't really realise at the time, but what had a massive impact on the match was the injury to Bernd Leno, not just because of the winning goal that Brighton scored and the lack of organisation in defence for Brighton's equaliser, but also for the way it clearly affected a number of Arsenal players in their ability to focus, and also, you know, some of the younger ones, particularly one, may have had their focus taken off what they should be doing and more diverted into how they were feeling about what happened.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about Guendouzi, how he was really fantastic in the first half and then dropped back in the second half and didn't play really well. Perhaps he was... It got to him the most out of the other players.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we all know that he's pretty easy to wind up. And anyone who's watched Championship football, and I mean, you know, Brentford are my second team, and Neil Pomerpo was a great player for Brentford, but nobody I know who watched him would ever dispute that he's a nasty, snide little fucker. And always has been, and like leaving his foot in and digging people in the ribs and like kneeing people in the back and all that shit. He loves all that stuff, and he's a wind up merchant too. You know, we even saw it in the first game when they beat us at the Emirates this season. He's always trying to do things to niggle his opponents, and to he's a nasty little fucker basically. And when he plays for your team, you sort of acknowledge that with more humour than when you do that when he's playing for the opposition.
Yeah, I think I'd absolutely hate Guendouzi playing for someone else.
Yeah, I mean, Guendouzi's definitely got a bit of that as well, for sure. Guendouzi hasn't yet developed the professional maturity to know how to use that to his advantage, whereas Mopé is a little more well-versed in dark arts.
Is that even possible? When you're playing for Arsenal, use something like that in it to your advantage. Because, I mean, we have seen, Lee has posted on Daily Can on Twitter a lot about the stats, how many yellow cards that we get for such little number of tackles and fouls and everything. Is it possible to even use that kind of, you know, let's say shithousery by players to your advantage at Arsenal? Because you feel like if a player goes a bit stronger and does something that it's pretty normal for say Brighton team or someone, he will get carded. He will get, you know, hounded by media the other day. It's really an odd situation to be in, and I think the players are thinking about that as well. You do such a little thing and you get a yellow card while the others are running away with murder.
Well, I anyone who's listened to this podcast before will know that I was going to get onto that subject. No, don't apologise. I mean, of course, the real art to shithousery is to know how to get away with it. That's like Lichtsteiner. He was a good shithouser. I mean, he was so far past his best, it was slightly painful for him to watch. But he, you know, he got carded for a few times and all the way, but he knew how to do things that were just basically massively wankery. He's like in people's, you know, he was a shithouser. And you know, as fans, we all like a little bit of shithousery, and so of course I totally understand why, you know, no Brighton fan's going to criticise Neil Mopé, and of course, you know, English football media
men, that seems to have its brain still stuck in the 1980s, seems to be quite happy to let people leave the foot in. But, I mean, we have to say it unequivocally, despite the fact that everyone seems to be going out of their way to absolve Mopé of any blame at all, including both Emi Martinez and Mikel Arteta. I'm not sure Bernd Leno feels the same way, judging by his reaction when being stretchered off. But the injury was caused by something totally unnecessary that's fundamentally dangerous, and in rugby, which is a much more physical sport, sees you sent off. Or at least sent to the sin bin for an extended period of time. The fact is jumping into someone in the air when they do not have full control over all their limbs because they're holding on to something is incredibly dangerous. And we've seen it be sanctioned very heavily in other sports. And the fact that everyone and their mother has come out this over the last couple of days and said, oh, he had every right to go for it, even though he didn't start jumping until Leno already had the ball in both hands and was off the air. It really makes me despair because it's just so incredibly stupid, and it's so reflective of prevailing attitudes that, particularly in England, which one of the reasons why England will never succeed on the international scale to the degree they should, given their resources and player ability, because they play in a way that isn't acceptable in other countries.
Yeah, and it's not only that he didn't start jumping before Leno got to the ball. It was clear that it was his intention to nudge Leno a bit, because right when Leno first fell down, the first reaction by Mopai was to point out that he was outside of his area.
Yeah, yeah.
Asking for a free kick. So that was definitely his intention, to nudge him and get him out of the area. So it was in his, but it wasn't obviously his intention to injure him and cause him to be stretched off. I don't believe that that's anyone's plans at all. But
indeed,
he did mean to, you know, slightly nudge him, push him out of the area, and it was really definitely unnecessary. Like we saw with Arnautovic and Nebushi, and I think it was it Alexis Sanchez, you know, when he sat down on the against Norwich, was it or someone?
I mean,
unnecessary.
Well, I mean, as you say, there's the key distinction. You know, nobody's accusing. I mean, you know, Neil Pope's a nasty little shit, but no one's accusing him of attempting to injure someone. Of course, I mean, you'd have to be psychopathic to be a professional sportsman and intentionally you'd have to be Roy Keane to intentionally injure another footballer. But the fact is that the prevailing argument seems to be that a lack of intention to injure someone means you have no responsibility for what happens to them as a result of your actions. Which for me, I find both a logical fallacy, but also immature to the degree of like a primary school child. Oh, I didn't mean to do it, but you did something which had consequences that you must have known has a range of potential consequences. If we applied the same thing more generally in life, you're the drink driver. Oh, I didn't mean to do it. You know, after they plough through two or three people on the street, you know. Ultimately, a fundamental part of adulthood is taking responsibility for the outcomes of your actions, even if those outcomes are unforeseen. And so that's why I find it such a fucking outrage, the response, not just to this, obviously, this is a relatively benign thing that has led to something terrible. But, you know, whether it be all what we saw in the late 90s of Arsenal players getting maimed, or even as we see with other players all over the place, you know, for lots of other teams, they get seriously injured because people are given carte blanche to not have to take responsibility for their actions. And I think that says the very fact that everyone's been lining up and all the pundits have been lining up to completely deny that element of responsibility says quite a lot about how puerile and immature our culture and our footballing culture is, that is deemed a get-out clause. I didn't mean to do it. I mean, you teach five-year-olds to stop saying that shit. So, yeah, anyway, that's my little rant about that.
That reminds me of, you know, when there are cars on the street, like in the middle of the lane with all four signals turned on, like they are just there and it's totally okay to park in the middle of the road because you have your four signal lights on.
Yeah.
That happens here in Croatia, at least, and it pisses me off because, you know, stopping the road. But if all fours are on, it's okay. You can do anything. It's like that. If you say, I didn't mean it, then it's okay.
Yeah. I mean, where does one draw the line in that? The thing is, that's not an admissible argument in any legal environment. So why the fuck should it be an admissible argument when you're applying it to a sporting environment where there are rules and laws in the same way they are within society?
But nothing will change because up and at 'em.
And they don't like it up 'em and all the rest of that bollocks. So we come out in the second half. We've seen how a couple of the players were clearly rattled by that, but Brighton, we have to acknowledge, made a good substitution. I don't know if it was at half time or a little bit later, I can't remember, but when Solly March came on, he definitely added a lot to their midfield and made them a lot more much more dangerous in transition. As he did the last time he played against us as well. He's a player that we haven't quite worked out how to combat. And I think that's partly due to a number of issues that we can see within the team, which we'll talk about more in a minute. But we have to say that after a very, very quiet first half, I mean, it was a wonderful goal from Pepe.
Yeah, just really seemed fantastic. It really looked amazing, and it seemed like, yes, that's it. It's happening now.
Yeah, I mean,
even though it's just, you know, just Brighton who are battling relegation.
Well, I mean, I think Brighton have got an excellent coach, Graham Potter. I think he's really smart. I think he's really improved them as a team. They were on an awful run before the lockdown, but we have to remember that they also had an extremely good run earlier in the season, and they're quite tight defensively, which means they're always in a game, even if they have trouble scoring goals, except against us. So obviously we've got the goal, we're in the ascendancy, but the equaliser comes pretty quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it seemed like, oh, typical set piece, scramble in defence, no one knows where they should stand, how it looks, and it goes in just barely, but obviously well enough, and yeah, just like Arsenal.
yeah. I mean, it was a fortuitous goal, but it was very badly defended. The fact, not so much Rob Holdings having his clearance charge down, which went in, I don't really have a problem with that, but the fact that the ball got to where it did to create that chaos in the first place meant that someone failed to do their job. And as someone else has argued on Twitter, you know, there's a decent chance that had Bernd Leno, who's been obviously getting more and more familiar with and confident at organising his defence, if he'd still been in goal, there's probably a greater chance that that ball might have been cleared. That's not to criticise Martinez. It's incredibly hard to come in when you haven't played in months and suddenly have to take charge of a defence.
And he did well stopping some shots.
Yeah, there was that very good save at the end of the first half, not long after
just
he came
as
on.
He came on.
I mean, Brighton will remain dangerous at set pieces. They've got a couple of excellent corner takers and free kick takers from out wide, and they've got a lot of big guys. I mean, you know, let's not forget their left back is a 6'5" ex centre half, which obviously gives them a major threat alongside their central defensive partnership, which is, you know, very physical and strong. And some of the midfielders are not exactly small either, so they're always going to be a threat to Arsenal from set pieces. But ultimately, that wasn't what caused the goal. So it's 1-1. Obviously, disappointment everywhere from an Arsenal perspective. And then what did you make of how the game played out after that?
Well, I wasn't really impressed with the Mikel Arteta's decisions in the match and the substitutions he made. I think that they came a lot too late, even though there was still time. I mean, it was 1-1 when the substitutions were made, and I was really expecting him to bring on at least Martinelli, if not even perhaps Mesut Ozil. I mean, we are still not sure what's up with him and that, but it's just, I think he definitely, just like players need to work on a lot of things in the game, I think he also needs to work on his in-match decisions as well.
Yeah, I think that's something which seems to be a pretty general conclusion amongst the supporter base, that it's sort of the opposite of Unai Emery, in that Unai Emery seemed to never be able to get a starting 11 to function, except at certain occasional points, but was, at least until towards the end, was quite good at intervening in games to make substitutions that impacted on the game positively for Arsenal. You know, of course, when Emery first joined, we were like, wow, a manager who makes substitutions when things aren't working rather than just waiting until 70 minutes, TM. Mm-hmm. Of course, that became less enthusing when we realised that the starting 11 for Unai Emery teams never seemed to work. Here we're a bit more in the Wenger mould, but without the same reading of the game, you know, in terms of how to make substitutions, perhaps change things up. And I too also think the substitutions were a bit late, and I think there were some decisions that could have been made which would have had a better impact for Arsenal, but that's because I presumably disagree with where the issues were in the Arsenal team, or there were players who were running out of legs but I wasn't aware of it, you know, or players that were struggling with fitness. That's always a consideration under the circumstances. But it did seem to be sort of petering out rather pointlessly towards a 1-1. And actually, I was literally in the process of walking out the room to turn on, to move on to what I was going to be doing after the football, as Brighton had their last attack.
What was it? 95th minute?
It was...
With 3 minutes added?
Yeah, it was the 95 minutes. It was the 95th minute in a 93-minute match.
Yeah. It's like, had all the things happen again in the same match, just like with Man City match as well. I mean, the big injury, the new goalkeeper coming in playing, then the referee making all those mistakes, and it just all ended with, you know, the typical one, the goal in the injury time that shouldn't supposed to happen, scored by the player that could have easily been either, you know, carded and then perhaps subbed off if he was, you know, in danger of getting a second card.
Or if the laws were as they are in other sports, he'd have been sent off.
And then Atkinson didn't allow us to have the corner kick either at the end of the match.
Yeah. Well, I mean, before we get on to peak Atkinson, because there's a whole different subject matter there. Yeah, I mean, it was something where we went wrong, but we have to admit that it was a good move from Brighton for their winning goal, but it was also embarrassingly bad defensively, I thought. it was that thing of people switching off because they think the match is over, and perhaps with some justification, but nonetheless, we all know that's not how it works. And so Arsenal managed to get no points from a game they really should have won even before they went ahead. It was just a little slightly more clinical play in the right areas.
Yeah, if that shot by Saka or header for Lacazette went in, I think the match would be a lot more different.
Yeah, indeed. But it turned out as it did, and I mean, there's not much else we can say about the match other than touching on the fact that having shithoused the goalkeeper injury and then getting the winning goal, Mope went for the hat trick and basically mugged us all off in the interview afterwards.
We're pissing Guendouzi off on the way out.
Yeah, who may face disciplinary action, partly as a result of Mope also, shall we say, exaggerating contact for visual effect.
Yeah, that one was just...
I mean, it was really the full house of absolute fuckwittery. But, you know, these players have always been around. They will always be around. He does good things for his team, and we're going to be stuck with dealing with his arsehole for some time to come. You know, that's just the reality of the situation, and all that really matters is how we react to it. And frankly, as a lot of people posted on Twitter, despite the refereeing that we're worried about and you mentioned and we'll talk about further, showing how angry you are after the final whistle is a bit fucking pointless. Ultimately, it's like, well, where was any of that during the game?
Exactly.
I mean, I thought the second half performance was listless, and particularly after we scored. It is this continuing theme with Arsenal. And of course, at the moment, it's going to be slightly influenced by the weird situation about coming back with, you know, the pandemic, and obviously the news that's come out this morning about the fact that Arsenal's preparations were disrupted due to a player testing positive and having to be self-isolated, and others that had been in his company having to be self-isolated so people couldn't train properly. So that must have had a significant impact on some of the preparations as well. You know, this has been a problem since the whole of Emery's era and before Emery, the last year and a half of Wenger as well, is this team is not consistently able to sustain 90 minutes of high-intensity football. And I don't just mean physical high-intensity, I mean like a mental intensity.
Yeah.
And I it's very hard to say why that is, because we don't know the individual personalities of the players and what is leading to it and where that energy comes from. But there is just a lack of, well, intensity in all kinds of ways within the squad. And Arteta is doing his best to try and drag that into things. I mean, his fairly unsympathetic comments towards the team after the final whistle against Brighton makes it clear that he's trying to get that, you know, that mentality that you need to win at the top level into the team. But it seems with this current collection of players, that's not going to be possible.
It's just what he keeps saying since he took over the club and everything, that a lot of things have to change around the club, not just, you know, the staffing, the players, the board or something like that, but the whole atmosphere, environment in the club, the, as you mentioned, the mentality to go into the match and stick around and be more intense during the match rather than afterwards, and stop trying to take the easy way out and, you know, sideways passing and stuff like that. Take some responsibility, even if you make a mistake, but just show that you are trying. And definitely will have to, all of them will have to work hard on that. Even Arteta, I tend to forget that this is his first real job. And I mean, I really like him as a person, as a former player and everything. And I do believe in his ideas and plans and all that. And I tend to get a bit distracted, you know, why did he make these subs right now? Why did he didn't try to do that? Why didn't he play this player? It's normal that he will make mistakes as well, and that he is learning on the job as well. And he too needs to, you know, take some responsibility after the bad results too, but not only the players. And it's just such a big, we are in the middle of such a big rebuild again, a cliche thing to say. And it's tough to say when we will get back, what will exactly happen, how much will we actually lose while doing this rebuild. I mean, it's really easy to see that perhaps, yeah, that there won't be any European football next season.
Well, no, it's looking rather less likely than it was a little while ago. I mean,
yeah, that when there was that news the other day about the top six clubs refusing to play the Europa League, the League Cup next season, asking to be left out, and you think, yeah, that would be a good idea to have more time for Europe, and then, oh, light bulb, yeah, we might not be in Europe next season, so...
Oh, well, it gives us a better chance of winning the League Cup.
yeah, until you run into, like, Birmingham or something.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, it's also the thing of, you know, coming into a new club and trying to reorientate the ship is just difficult. Let alone halfway through a season. I mean, we got spoiled by the Wenger miracle.
Yeah, you see that right now that he's gone.
But, well, I mean, particularly the miracle of him turning up and and having such a profound impact so quickly. But in that situation, of course, we have to remember that there was a foundation of very good players at the team. You know, not just good players in terms of people like Bergkamp and Wright and Platt and Vieira, who had been signed by then, but also they had one of the best defensive lineups in modern football history.
Yeah.
Yes, they hadn't been at their peak form, but those players were still the players they were. And when Klopp turned up at Liverpool, obviously now he's the Messiah because he's done a fantastic job and Liverpool have bought really well and the team has been transformed. And Klopp has clearly very evidently been a very good coach for a long time. But, you know, his first season, he had more time than Arteta. He managed to get him from 10th to 8th with a much better squad than Arsenal currently have in terms of depth of senior professionals with top level experience, and what I mean top level experience as opposed to just experience, and when Pep turned up at Man City and tried to get them playing his style of football, the first season it didn't really work and lots of people were questioning whether he could do it, and that was with the most expensively assembled squad of all time. it's really not easy. Even if you've got a full season, let alone walking in halfway through a season in a team that is in complete disarray with a dysfunctional setup at a club and a squad that has been assembled by like schizophrenia, I think the way I look at it with Arteta is you look for the positive signs, you hope he learns from some of the things he hasn't had the experience of doing before, which is A, making the in-game decisions, and you basically write the season off as far as he's concerned. You know, I've heard some people making comments about, you know, maybe he's not. It's like, well, the situation he's walked into, all we can possibly hope for is to see signs of improvement over what preceded it, and that some of the players that will be part of our future rather than our present show signs of development. Everything else beyond that would be very nice, but isn't really likely given the situation. I mean, you know, yes, this week has been tough, and of course after the Brighton game we felt very down for a number of reasons, but we have to just think back to how bad things were for the last few weeks under Unai Emery. how basically we got to the point where people didn't even want to watch the games, and you know, Lacazette scored a last minute equaliser and everyone's like, oh Christ.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact is that we were unbeaten in 2020 and before the lockdown. I mean, minus the Olympiacos.
Yeah.
But in the Premier League. And he did bring something positive that you could see, yeah, okay, he has some plans. It will need to take some time and it will happen. I mean, perhaps not this season, but more likely next season. But then, right now, when we are restarting the league and everything, I just can't help but think how perhaps even the board are letting him down as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a lot about this on Arsenal Twitter, and obviously there's been a lot of antipathy towards the board for a period of time. I mean, the great difficulty is because of the increased lack of transparency, not that the Arsenal board is ever particularly transparent, we can speculate because we're not happy about things or that things don't seem to be happening in the way that we'd want, but we genuinely don't know. You know, there's been rumours that Kroenke's put some personal money into the club, but because we don't get to see the figures anymore, we don't know.
Yeah. And I mean, it gives me headache, and I can't imagine how Arteta must feel that he has to build the team for the upcoming match, and then still think how many of these players will be available next season. What's up with the contracts? They are expiring right now in a week or so. It's just really a tough situation to be in for any kind of coach manager, especially for one that this is his first proper job.
Yeah, and as you say, you know, when three or four of the rival teams you're competing with just do not have to have those concerns because they've just got so much money that they can make any problem essentially go away.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. However, you know, there are other teams like Wolves and so on who seem to have a greater cohesion in the way they're working. But again, we have to remember that most of these other teams that are outperforming Arsenal have had a consistency of club structure, boardroom structure, managerial tenure, and whoever's been in charge of actually signing and building the squad, you know, signing players and building the squad. Arsenal, everything, like everything, has changed in the last year and a half.
Yeah.
I mean, the you know, everything for the board, the boardroom, the board structure, the ownership structure, the executive structure, the director of football, the youth setup, the coach, the backroom staff, quite a lot of the playing squad have all changed in 18 months or less. So while we would like more signs of reassurance, I mean, I wrote about this a bit last year, you know, it is unrealistic for us to expect that we're going to have a cohesive club approach now. Obviously, the hope is that some of the decisions being made will lead to a more modern and cohesive way of working down the line. That, of course, depends on the individuals involved, and we don't know, we haven't seen enough of said individuals to make a decision about that. I mean, obviously, a lot of people are very critical of Sanier because of his contacts-led approach, and that's a very valid concern. But ultimately, we have, you know, that judgment is being made on a mixed bag of signings since he turned up. Some have been good, some have been bad. And so, you know, we can't say, you know, the whole thing's fucked up because we bought David Luiz and it's costing us more money than it's worth and he might mug us off because we're not willing to give him a long contract. But at the same time, celebrate the fact we've bought Martinelli and Pepe and other things. So I think we just don't know. I mean, don't get me wrong, I quite dislike Stan Kroenke as a human being from what I know about him as a human being. I think some of the criticism labelled at the sports teams is unfair because a couple of the sports teams have gone through periods of significant overachievement, actually, and their ice hockey franchise is in very good shape. For me, it seems that the pattern is they tend to be quite hands-off and sometimes take too long to realise they've made the wrong decisions. And ultimately, it all becomes about the efficacy of who they hire. And the jury's out on that at the moment at Arsenal. And even though we've all got suspicions about some of the people who've been hired, we can't really hold them as legitimate evidence because it's not enough time.
That's a really great rant, Matthew.
Yeah, well, you know. Oh, and it's not a rant. I could get a lot more vehement about it, I can assure. We haven't started talking about
monologue. Yeah. Maybe.
We haven't started talking about the refs yet. If you want a rant,
yeah, I think no one at the club, starting with the fans and ending with the, you know, stakeholders and boards and everything, had to think about anything besides, you know, a few things over the last 20 years.
Mm.
It was Wenger made this decision. He was signing players. He was assigning staff around him, and it was more or less all about him, and it looked really good. And now that we are all involved in this, it's just really, really hard to tell what will happen, what will, you know, because I mean, us as fans, we see things happening on the pitch and we see players who are playing together and perhaps they sometimes they don't fit, they don't work together, and it's easy to see, sometimes it's hard to see. But so much more happened around the club, as you listed. How many staff and the coaches and the academy team, everything has been changing around the club. And it's all like a domino effect as well. It's not just, you know, players, bad signings or something like that. It's the whole organization has been changed, and it's really ungrateful to expect things to work out right away.
Well, it's also the thing of, like I totally support scrutiny and questioning. But, you know, I've seen quite a lot of people online slagging off Edu. And it's like, I mean, he may well be full of shit, but we just can't know because he hasn't, like, he hasn't been in position long enough to do anything. Apart, you know, in terms that we can see the results of. Obviously, he's been doing things, but we don't know what they are. The only thing we can seem to see is that he has this relationship with Kira Jerebchin, which is not something we're comfortable with, and with good reason, and that's led to us bringing in a couple of players in on loan, who one has now got injured and the other one has been injured. But we can't form conclusions about whether those are good things or not, because they're so recent, and the longer term implications of those haven't played out. I mean, Cedric Suarez, is he good enough to be an Arsenal player as a backup right back? We don't know. Is the fact he'd been injured a massive issue? Yes, but if we sign him for free and if that's always been the intention, and he's had 6 months to integrate into the squad or 5 months to integrate into the squad ahead of actually starting to play for us, that might turn out to be a good thing. Or we might not sign him, and we've paid a few million quid to see if he's good enough. We don't know. You know, we know that Edu was involved in conversations around Martinelli, but we don't know if he actually was involved in decision-making. So we don't know if that's a credit either, because he turned up in the summer and after we'd done most of our transfer business. So people are kind of trying to write him off on the basis of two loans that have really had very little time to assess.
And it's not like we haven't signed injured players before.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nothing new.
Yes, it's true. It's true. It's a theme. It's a theme.
I often wonder, do other clubs' fans, you know, go that deep into the analysis and asking questions which you now ask, and all the fans, Arsenal fans, are asking and questioning every single decision, like every single step the board makes, and do other clubs do that?
I mean, I suspect it varies, obviously, you know, each fan base has a lot of different strata within it, but I think it's happening more at Arsenal at the moment because there has been this underpinning feeling of regression and dissatisfaction for a long period of time. You know, if you feel like things are ticking on quite well and improving, you're less inclined to look very closely. Whereas if, as has been the case for Arsenal, things have clearly gone backwards and there's been lots of things have been changed, then you're going to look more closely because you want to know what the fuck's going on. So I think that's part of it. And I think also, you know, the Arsenal fan base is massive. It is one of the biggest fan bases in the world. And therefore, just by virtue of probability, there's going to be more people looking at this shit. Because let's not forget, it may not always feel like it, but Arsenal FC is a massive club. Before I wanted to discuss a little bit more, jumping off that really, about the sort of steps, ways to move forward. But just before I do that, we do have to, as you mentioned it earlier, talk about the officiating. You know, you referred to the various different articles that Lee on the Daily Canon site, but also have appeared in enough of other places that clearly state that Arsenal statistically are treated very differently to a lot of the other teams in the Premier League. You know,
whether it's two or three times twice more likely to get a book, twice or three times more likely to get booked for committing a foul than the other teams in the Premier League, depending on where they are on that table. Arsenal have by far the highest ratio of getting booked for committing fouls in the league, and that's been the case, or trending in that direction for a while. And also Arsenal have been on the receiving end of records of the players who've committed most fouls without being booked, with Bissouma equaling the other against Arsenal record this season. And that's just including the fouls that were given against him, not including the ones where he took players out off the ball with clotheslines, etc., three or four times in the game. And this is something that, people know that I have a lot of frustrations about referees, and I rant about it a bit, and have a massive issue with the way that the match officials organisation is run, and who's running it, and have cited various different other professional people criticising it heavily. But I have to say, one of my reactions after the game at the weekend, and this is why I'm mentioning it, was sort of realising that obviously supporting Arsenal at the moment isn't that much fun because we're a bit crap and not showing a lot of the qualities that we've traditionally associated with the Arsenal teams. But I realised watching a bit of football since the restart, having had that break from it, that it isn't that actually just the quality of refereeing in the Premier League, even in games where I don't care about the outcome, like Palace, Bournemouth or whatever, like the standard of refereeing is actually making it harder for me to enjoy the games. I found watching football over the weekend harder because the referees were so poor in so many parts of so many of the games. And I've never really had that thought before. I've only ever had that thought in relation to Arsenal before, but I've never really sort of seen it that broadly. Do you have any thoughts?
Well, yeah, I would agree. I didn't watch many Premier League matches since its restart. I did go watch the Spurs against United one.
Some cracking decisions in that game, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Even though I fell asleep before the penalty calls, but I saw the replays, and yeah, those were just in line with the standard of the English referees. And yeah, I have to agree. They tend to frustrate you with just random stuff, random decisions, and it just feels like the thing that frustrates me the most is the inconsistency that they show, not only from one match to another, but inside the same match as well. Mm. You never know what will they do, how will they will give a call for this. This will be a foul, this will be a yellow card, but on the other side this won't be. It could be even be on the same player, and just that's the one thing that frustrates me the most about the English referees, besides the biased part about Arsenal.
Well, it is that thing, and I was actually, because I know I bang on about it and people call me out for my bias, and probably rightly so, so I thought I'd actually look into it, and I realised that actually Arsenal have a decent record with some of the referees I have least faith with in charge, and actually some of the referees I think are best, Arsenal have poor records with them refereeing matches. So I thought maybe it's my bias about liking the referees with whom Arsenal do better when they're refereeing. Arsenal got a pretty good record with Martin Atkinson as referees. I think it's like the second or third highest win percentage for any active or recent match official has been with Martin Atkinson in charge. And yet, I think he's an appalling referee. I don't think he's the worst. I think there are three or four that are competing for that title. But actually, I think Michael Oliver's a very, very good referee. We've got a worse record under Michael Oliver than any other referee in Premier League history.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think he's one of the best referees in the country. And part of the reason we've got such a bad record is because they tend to save him up for the really big games, where, of course, yeah, in recent years we have an appalling record. But it's like, there are people like... Atkinson's a bit more scattergun, so he frustrates me just because it's like, I don't... I know you're going to get lots of things wrong, but I have no idea what way they're going to go because you're just not very good. But then you've got people like Anthony Taylor and John Moss, who actually Arsenal have a decent record with John Moss as referee, but I think he's an appalling referee. Like, I think he's incapable of keeping up with play. I think his decision making is so wildly off at times that you wonder, like, you wonder how you're trying to work out how he's got to a decision. And so it isn't just about the impact on Arsenal games. It is literally that there are, in my perception, there are a number of referees that basically just aren't good enough and don't seem to be getting any better at their jobs, even if you look at the bias statistics that are put out that can congratulate them on the correctness of the decisions, even if they're including, like, giving a throw-in to the right team as part of their assessing people's correct decisions. You know, when someone kicks it out for a goal kick with no one anywhere near them, and that's, well done, you got something right. And, you know, for me, it's like, the frustration is, I understand why match officials have to be protected and why you can't be too transparent, but the total lack of any transparency and the total lack of what appears to be consequence for on-pitch ability, as opposed, you know, we've all seen referees get demoted for, like, being a twat on social media or driving somewhere in a company car and what have you. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that Mark Clattenburg was a bellend, but he was also one of the country's best referees. And he was always getting punished for things which didn't have anything to do with his ability to do his job, whereas other referees seem to continually get high-profile fixtures despite the fact that they're just not very good. And I know that another thing that Lee reported about, and I don't know if you've got any thoughts on this, is the fact that Atkinson gets so many more Arsenal games than all the other referees in the last couple of years. Like,
yeah,
he's like had between a third and a quarter of all Arsenal games in the last 2 years have been reffed by Atkinson, and then half the others he's been a fourth official. And it's like, well, why? Surely that just shouldn't be possible. I mean, yes, it may be a reflection of the fact they're saving their best referees for big games that are title deciding or relegation deciding, and we're not either. That's a consideration. But there is no real logical justification for why any referee should have such regular contact with any team. It just reminds me of when Mike Riley, head of the referees now, got when United beat us to the title by a few points all those years ago, he got like 10 United games in the second half of the season. And gave them a penalty in all but one of those games. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's anything to add or what you might want to say, but I just find it bewildering.
Yeah, you often find yourself thinking, am I just, you know, being too biased, just seeing one side of the things? And then you look at the stats, which Lee kind of keeps talking about, and still being called biased and, oh, face it, we are just bad. Don't take it out on the referees, but you have to, because the referees influence the match, especially when they are bad ones. They influence the match so much, especially our matches as well, with the red cards, the poor decisions, the goals being taken. I mean, that was before the VAR and everything. You have to comment on the referees. They are a big part of any football match, and it would be really wrong to, you know, try to comment on the football alone and not talk about the officials. It's just, they have really been bad over the last few seasons and getting worse.
Yeah, I mean, that's the worrying thing, isn't it? It seems that standards seem to be declining. And also, of course, the fact that VAR has been introduced, but it's been introduced in a way which is very flawed in a lot of ways. You know, it's a lot of people have turned against VAR. But again, as we've said before, that's just about implementation. You know, there are so many things that in other sports, particularly, I mean, rugby's a fine example. Yes, it's a stop-start game, so you can't apply it in the same way. But when it comes to decisive decision-making, the way it's handled in rugby, not just in terms of how the decisions are made, but also the way those decisions are communicated, particularly to fans within the stadium themselves, it's like light years ahead. Again, you're looking at the way that
you don't know, maybe there's pressure from UEFA or FIFA about how they want things done, but it seems utterly incomprehensible the way that certain things are done. And also there's, because VAR is just being run by the same match officials who run the matches rather than, you know, video refereeing specialists, which is ultimately what they need to do. And if they don't aspire to that in the long term, that's just ignoring what every other sport has done successfully. But it means you end up with incredibly inconsistent application of VAR because it's being applied by people who are always incredibly inconsistent with where they apply things anyway. And so, that's still a hope for me that it will improve things, but if they continue doing it the way they're doing it now and implementing the way they have been, it's going to be a long way off before we see that improvement. And that just makes me quite angry, because that's just negligence and people not doing their job properly when it comes to decision making. But anyway, all we can say about the two matches that we've had is that in the first game at Man City, I thought the ref was fucking useless but didn't really impact the game. And I think in the second game, the ref had a major impact upon the game and allowed the game to be played in the way that suited Brighton and applied the rules completely differently to the two teams at different points. We're so used to it, and I'm sure there's fans of other teams that feel the same way. And I'm not suggesting there's a big anti-Arsenal conspiracy. I do think there are certain referees who are more prone to giving decisions against us, particularly those who Wenger may have criticised in the past with long memories, which is presumably why Arteta never says anything about referees. He's not stupid enough to poke the bear. Yeah, there's fuck all we can do about it, so I suppose we just have to lump it. Which brings me back, the only other thing I wanted to say about the Brighton game is one thing it really echoed in my mind is the comparison between that and previous Arsenal teams in similar circumstances. I was thinking particularly back to when Aaron Ramsey had his legs snapped in two by that fucking gorilla up at Stoke. And the Arsenal reaction that day, once they got over the trauma of what happened, and led by Fabregas, was, we are fucking not losing this game. We are going to win this game. And I didn't see any of that against Brighton. I didn't see anyone really offering that leadership or taking scruff of it or just having that refusal to just let things drift. There was a passivity within the team, which we've seen far too much, and this is sort of a transition to the last thing I wanted to talk about, which is sort of looking at things moving forward. But yeah, the passivity of this group, is it confidence? Is it personalities? I don't know, but there's nothing about the best qualities of the Arsenal teams I grew up with, and even the ones that you would have started watching when you started becoming an Arsenal fan a few years later, I don't see most of those qualities in this team. And I don't know how to instill that. But of course, there are lots of other things we can and should be looking at as a club to improve. And I wanted to know your thoughts on it, because you mentioned it earlier.
Well, yeah, I think you mentioned how we dropped when we scored the goal, instead of, you know, pushing forward and going forward for perhaps another goal, we gave Brighton a few chances and they obviously equalized. And it's been happening in a lot of too many matches over the last few seasons. Really, really hard to say, because I mean, yeah, obviously this season and most of the last season we had most of the same players at the club and, you know, doing the same things again. But it's not like only this season and last season. It's been happening for a while now. And you have to think, is it just, you know, club thing? Do we sign that kind of players that will fit in this kind of mindset? I was really hoping that, I was really encouraged by Arteta's comments during the lockdown, that he has been working with the players individually, talking to them about the plans and tactics and everything. And I was kind of, you know, expecting him to work with them on the mentality side of things, because I kind of get this feeling that more of the younger modern coaches and managers tend to think about that aspect of the the game as well, more perhaps more than the, you know, old guard of managers. But so far, I mean, yes, it's only been 2 matches, and it's tough to say it under the circumstances they played out in. It just doesn't seem like we have been working on that as much as I was hoping for and wishing for.
I mean, I suppose the question regarding that specific element is, can you make a difference with people who aren't predisposed to that to that way of doing things? You know, we all know it needs a critical mass. I mean, Tony Adams famously talked about, you know, you need 6 or 7, you know, in terms of you needed that many people that if it got into a ruck, you felt would be with you. And of course, every best Arsenal team has had that, you know, or at least 3 or 4, you know, players that you thought that if it got into a physical confrontation, they would step up, and not in a kind of handbags petulant way, but step up in a way that says, you know, we're going to protect each other to the last. And obviously football has changed, so you don't get that kind of incident as much, and that's probably a good thing, but we haven't seen much evidence to suggest there's enough of those personalities in the squad at Arsenal. And of course it's difficult because a lot of the squad's very young, and certainly the players that Arteta seems to be enjoying working with most, as evidenced by his lineup against Man City, are some of the younger players, presumably because he feels he can mould them into what he wants rather than just having to find out how to fit them into his way of doing things, which is what he was doing before lockdown. But of course it's very, very difficult for young players to bring that into a senior environment when they don't have the status to do that and probably don't have the confidence and experience to do that. So it really is on the more senior players. And I guess, how many of our senior players would you think have that in their character?
Well, I think a lot of players commented about Granit Xhaka, you know, when all the controversy of making him a captain and stripping him of captaincy again, all the players kept saying how he is important in the team, he is helping the team, you know, the teammates in more stuff than just on the pitch. So I would, he comes to mind first when you talk about that, but not many others. I mean, obviously we had Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang not so long ago, who was just a perfect example of something, of a player like that, that you would like to have there to lead the youngsters, especially in the defense. But right now, I only can think of Granit Xhaka. And I mean, Aubameyang is the captain of the team, but I don't see him as that type of player. He often seems to me like, he gives up, or, you know, waves his hands and gets angry at the players rather than, you know, keeping and going forward, motivating them and working with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think Aubameyang's the other sort of character you also need in a squad, which is he's the joker, he's laughing, he's very positive, he's bubbly, he's outgoing, he's very popular. Yeah. And you definitely need that in a squad too, in any working environment. But it's that critical mass, isn't it? You need enough people with a similar enough mentality, or you need, you know, a smaller number of incredibly dominant characters with that mentality. You know, it's no surprise that Man City were always a better team when Vincent Kompany was fit.
Yeah.
Because
he's definitely a good example for that.
You know, he's very much an archetypal leader. And even when he was injured, if he was close enough to fitness to be around the squad, the team did better even if he wasn't playing. But when he was out for a very long time, or when he left, their concentration intensity levels dropped a little bit. And that's despite having an incredibly successful manager with a hand-picked squad of multi-million pound stars who are all incredibly talented, and a lot of them also have that mentality anyway. You know, so it shows the importance of these characters. But of course, the way that football culture has changed, there is less than about making it to the top level these days. You know, I think when standards technically were lower, players with stronger personalities could flourish more easily, because if they were technically weren't quite as good, it didn't matter quite as much. But now you've got such high technical levels across the sport, that's what's getting prized more all the way through development, whereas players whose primary attribute is their character and their strength of personality, you know, if they're a little bit technically behind, it's much harder for them to get to that point in where they're able to be exposed to playing at the top level. Okay, well, I mean, that's a very difficult one to solve, because it involves getting very specific sorts of people and changing the mentality of the team and the club. But I mean, looking elsewhere at things which seem more plausible, I mean, you know, we're, this season is approaching write-off territory where it's probably going to be playing more and more of the young players. We have a captain who's a brilliant goal scorer but is slightly disengaged and is probably going to leave because we're underachieving. We have some of our central defenders. You know, Socrates can't get any games and has made noises about wanting to go. Mustafi, we either need to renew his contract or sell him. David Luiz, who the hell knows what's going on with that situation.
Rob Holding, who had some injury issues over the past.
Yeah. So there's a lot of uncertainty. But obviously, we're not going to have a shit ton of money, but so we can't address all those issues at once. So what would you prioritise? I don't mean a name, I just mean a type of player that you think Arsenal could make the biggest one or two players could make the biggest difference to this team.
Well, you know, now after the Brighton match, one more position came up that well, should be addressed. That we, none of us thought that that would be our priority, because I, even though I really like Emi Martinez and I think he's a really decent goalkeeper, Matt Macy, I think there were some rumors that his contract is out at the end of the month, but
apparently
he
extended for 12 months. Yeah,
again, do we need to sign another goalkeeper?
Well, we might do. I guess we haven't had the full prognosis on Bernd Leno, so we don't know. We know he's going to be out for a while, but we don't know how serious the ligament injury will be.
Yeah, whatever happened, that will definitely have to be the priority over the summer transfer window, because you have to have decent goalkeepers in starting the matches and in the reserve if needed, and, you know, for the faint hope of European football or the cups and everything. So that's one that I think is out of the equation, out of the question, that has to be addressed over the summer. And other than that, really tough to predict. I did like the rumors going around about Partey. Did I say that right? I hope I did. And yeah, maybe that someone in the midfield, because we have been looking really slow and uninspired and not going forward well in the midfield. And I think that was, you know, when I started supporting Arsenal, our midfield was what made me fall in love with the club. You know, it was Fabregas, it was Klepp, it was Rosicki, it was Flaminian, you know. He wasn't that. But, you know, that's the part that made me fall in love with the club, and I would definitely love to see something like that happen. And with all the things happening around Mesut Özil, no matter how good I think he is, and most of the time, well, not in all the matches, but you know what I mean. Just, you know, all the uncertainty around him. Will he play? Can he play? Can he play the whole match? What is he thinking now? Is he in the good mood to play?
Yeah.
And, you know, and the paycheck and everything around that. I don't see it happening, but I would be... I think we could work on offloading him, perhaps, and not signing Ceballos, because, as mentioned... His good match, one good match seemed like an exception rather than the rule, and work on getting someone in the midfield to get the balls to the really good forward line, I think.
Well, you'd be surprised to know that I entirely agree. I do think that one thing that has been really exposed, I mean, for the last 2 years, but also, you know, being reminded of, is the lack of mobility and dynamism in our central midfield is, like, it's quite depressing, really. It's not just about having a Vieira-like physical beast that can just charge up, you know, do box to box in 15 seconds and kill everyone in the process. But it's, you need someone who can physically compete, at least, because we don't have midfielders that can do that. I mean, Xhaka's quite strong and obviously is very positionally aware most of the time, so has definite useful attributes. But we don't have any midfielders apart from the likes of Maitland-Niles and Willock, who are obviously not ready to own a midfield.
Yeah.
We don't have anyone that can ever keep pace with people breaking on us. And we don't have anyone that can ever leave people behind running forward in central areas. You know, our central pitch is very one-paced. There's a lot of... it's as well as physically, it's stylistically, it's one-paced. It's not dynamic. I don't... How often do we get the ball in central midfield and think one of these central midfielders is going to make something happen? You know, whenever it does, it's a surprise.
Yeah, it's more like safe passes and you do something.
Yeah, I mean, it's just sort of, as you was alluding to earlier, it's that bravery, it's that taking the responsibility, which we have seen Guendouzi try and do at times, but we're still working out what Guendouzi is as a player. Is he a deep-lying player? Is he more of a multi-positional player? We don't really know what he is. We know there's a boy there with a lot of talent, but he doesn't seem to have a clearly defined role, and he doesn't seem to have the tactical awareness yet to play a clearly defined role. And he's never going to be someone that is really contributing much in the final third. He's not got that skill set. And so I think anything that could bring greater energy, strength, pace, and just bravery in our central midfield I wouldn't go as far to say transformative, but it would be a major, major, major difference for this club, because as you said, midfield was our strong point for a long time, and for the last basically since Cazorla, Coquelin stopped being a thing, our central midfield has been weak, with occasional exceptions of being very good.
and a goal or two from midfield every now and then wouldn't be bad as well.
yeah. And of course, you know, we're looking at players there. Obviously, I've mentioned Maitland-Niles seems to be at least back in consideration, and he's got a lot of the attributes you'd want, but doesn't seem to have quite the mentality.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that to be critical for him. It may be a confidence thing. I've always thought that Maitland-Niles is a guy that comes across as very cool and disinterested, but is actually a bit shy and not very confident, and needs to find that within himself if he's ever going to take a step forward. And Willock is he's got a lot of exciting qualities, but is not remotely ready to be taking on a major role. He's the guy you want to be getting 15 minutes off the bench, the odd start. You know, which is exactly where you'd expect for a player in his position at his point in his career. Obviously everything else depends on what happens. You know, will we have any strikers? Will we have any defenders? We don't know. With all the uncertainties surrounding everything. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is looking at the two games we've played and the performances of Lacazette and Nketiah. What did you make of that?
Well, I mean, we know Lacazette isn't that good in the away matches for us or his Arsenal career, but he was really close to scoring against Brighton, and as we mentioned before, Nketiah was probably our best player going forward against Man City, so I think, yeah, we are playing Southampton away, I think.
Yeah.
In the FA Cup, I would go with Nketiah on that one.
We got Southampton away in the league, and the cup is Sheffield United, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, I
I would say at this point, Nketiah is offering more to the team, actually. Yeah. I having watched Nketiah against City and then watched Lacazette against Brighton, obviously Lacazette's got more refinement to his game and his takes up different positions and is slightly better in the build-up, but I just thought the difference in work rate between the two was quite stark, actually. And, you know, I believe that Lacazette has also been affected by the speculation around him and the broader uncertainty. You know, I know that he's sort of got involved in social media things about, you know, people speculating about his future, and he's responded on more than one occasion. So it's obviously a preoccupation for him. It's obviously something that's worrying him, or he's thinking about it, and I don't know if that's impacting on his play, but I was quite struck by how much more pressure Nketiah was putting on opposition defences, how much more his runs were stretching opposition defences, how much more he was trying to win the ball back in midfield. Different games, different priorities and what have you, but I thought that was you could really see why Arteta's been talking Nketiah up, actually. After that, because he just had more of an impact on our ability to compete in the game, despite the fact it was against much stronger opposition.
Yeah.
Although, you know, that's not to discount Lacazette. I mean, he created a chance for Aubameyang, which in a different day might have scored. He, you know, nearly scored himself. So it's not, but it really does. It's showing that Nketiah is a genuine alternative as opposed to just a young guy we're giving games.
Agreed.
Right. We've gone on for quite a while, so we'll wrap this up. But just before we do, we've got another game this week. We've got two games this week. We've got the... I think that's going to be a theme for a while. But we've got Southampton away in the league, which is, of course, a very happy hunting ground for Arsenal. Nets not. And then we've got Sheffield United away in the FA Cup. Sheffield United, who surprisingly got spanked at the weekend in what was quite a shocking result. I mean, what's your feeling about those games? Obviously, we're going to have quite a few players missing. Happy days.
Yeah, and I'm still not sure about the Guendouzi, what will happen there, will he get a ban or not for his reaction to after the match against Brighton. And yeah, I mean, I would go definitely, as mentioned, with Nketiah starting the match and seeing how that goes. Perhaps go try with Aubameyang up front instead of playing on the wing, and depending on what the situation is, why not give Mesut Özil a run?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what. Obviously, it's been very cryptic comments. Basically, something that seems to suggest that Özil isn't fully fit.
You know, I got with the news coming out today on the.
You can't help wondering.
Yeah, I was thinking perhaps Mesut Özil was the one that tested positive. That was my initial thought.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I have to admit, I had exactly the same thought. Because Arteta was sort of... He's basically saying he can't play, but it's not his fault, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, he was on the bench against Brighton, so probably he's fit enough to feature. And, I mean, as you said, we are long done with this season, right before the lockdown happened.
Yeah.
So why not try something like that?
Yeah, and I could see, if Guendouzi's missing, we've got a problem midfield, so that might lead to Maitland-Niles getting a start, because obviously if you're going to have to play, if you're going to have to find a deeper midfield, he's a better option than Willock, who's not a number 10, but it doesn't really have much defensive awareness despite decent effort levels, particularly if Torreira is still not quite back yet.
Yeah, I think it's a few weeks for Torreira still.
So, but Southampton obviously won very comfortably at Norwich. Good goals they scored as well, which led some pundit. Who was it this morning? There was some twat pundit saying that Danny Ings was better than Aubameyang.
Of course.
But
he took those clicks.
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, having said that, Danny Ings has had a great season, and after his terrible injury problems, you know, I'm really pleased for him, because I think always thought he was a player that was underrated and unlucky. But yeah, I mean, how are you feeling about the away trip to Southampton? Are you optimistic, pessimistic, or don't really care?
I'm just thinking, what else could go wrong this time?
Christ, don't tempt fate, Anita.
We had two injuries in the same match in the opening 20 or so minutes. We had the red cards, we had penalties, we had goalkeeper injured, goal conceded, winner conceded in the dying minutes of the match. What else could happen this time?
Answers on a postcard too.
And it's like, you know, third time lucky, third match, third away match. I'm going to go with the win. I can't help it. I have a few beers stocked up, so.
Well, yeah. Well, I hope your beers bring us luck, because they do always say that things come in threes. So, to be honest, I think it'll be a draw. I think it'll be a better performance from Arsenal. I think Southampton will be pretty good. But I think there does come a point where top players, and we've still got two or three of those, where the players have a certain degree of professional pride. And if he's able to play, I expect Aubameyang to get a goal against Southampton, particularly as I think they're vulnerable down that side of their defence as well.
That's really good for him, for the confidence.
Yeah. And then, of course, we've got Sheffield United, hardly any time after that in the FA Cup. They had a rather different experience in their first game back, losing 3-0 at Newcastle. Do you think that's the interruption to their season may have a negative impact on that fluidity, or do you think it was just a bit one-off?
Well, I haven't watched the match, so really, it does seem like a big defeat for them. So let's go with a disruption, downward spiral. You know? But I think it's an FA Cup. It's a completely different competition that we can still win despite the situation we are in right now, but winning that would really be a massive, massive thing for us. So I think that Arteta will definitely focus on that one more, and I think we're going to win that one for sure.
Yeah, I think we'll win at Sheffield United as well. I think despite my great admiration for the work Chris Wilder has done there and the way that he's got so much improvement out of some of those players who I remember seeing playing in the bottom half of the Championship or below, and the fact that, you know, no team's really found a way of consistently dealing with the fluidity they have, I do think that Sheffield United were incredibly lucky to beat us at their place. You know, I mean, that was a plethora of appalling refereeing decisions again. Like,
which feels years ago.
Well, it does, yeah. And even though I was impressed with them when they played at the Emirates, I think they're vulnerable. And as you say, you know, given that the league is, and getting any reward out of the league is almost gone, particularly if we don't get a win at Southampton, I think you know, those players that do have the right mentality to play for Arsenal Football Club will step up against Sheffield United in the FA Cup. So I'm going for a draw, a 1-1, and then a 2-1 away victory.
Sounds good.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there, because this has been quite an epic, but that's what happens. There's two matches in the week and the entire state of the nation. Yeah, there's been lots to talk about. But just to say thanks again, listeners, for getting this far, if you have. If you want to get in touch with us, do get in touch with us. It's at Daily Cannon on Twitter, or you can contact either me or Anita on Twitter directly if you'd like to. You probably all follow Anita already, and if you don't, you should. And if you want to follow me, it's at LOMEKIAN on Twitter. And obviously that will be in the description for wherever you access this podcast. And thanks for talking to us. Thanks for talking to me, Anita, and to everyone else. Always.
It was fun to dissect football again.
And always great to have you on, just because you make me feel slightly less depressed about things.
Happy to help.
And I hope you all have a lovely week. And I hope by the time we speak next, we've actually won a game. Have a lovely time, everyone. Enjoy the weather if it's good where you are. Commiserations if it's not where you are. And stay safe.
They're still lurky going around, so look after yourselves.
Cheerio. Bye-bye.